We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be spending some time talking about how communities rebuild after natural disasters. And the guest for the program is Robert Olshansky. He's professor and associate head of urban and regional planning here at the University of Illinois, and his teaching and research covers land use and environmental planning and has a special emphasis on planning for natural disasters. He's done a lot of writing on post-disaster recovery planning and also in planning and policy for earthquake risks. He studied recovery after several major earthquakes, most notably the one that took place in Kobe, Japan in 1995. He's also been involved in planning and reconstruction in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, in post-earthquake development opportunities not only in Kobe but also in Los Angeles. And he's also been involved in planning, trying to plan to reduce the risks of earthquake, that is to make things make the infrastructure more robust in case that there is an earthquake. He's authored co-authored a book that will be coming out later this summer that's focused on New Orleans. That book's scheduled to be out in August. The title is Clear as Mud, Planning for the Rebuilding of New Orleans. I'm sure we'll touch on New Orleans. Perhaps then later in a couple of months he can come back and we'll talk specifically about New Orleans. One of the things that he says is that while every disaster is unique, there are certain challenges that come up again and again. And he says at the heart of reconstruction, there's this tension between speed and deliberation, between the need to rebuild as quickly as possible and also the need to slow down and think and include as many people as possible. So we'll talk generally about some of his experiences and some of the work that he's done. I know he was in Haiti recently, and we can talk about that. And questions, comments, they're certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for asking me.
I appreciate it. One of the things that I'm sure that we'll talk about is Haiti. People know, of course, that the country was struck by a devastating earthquake in January. A lot of people died. There was a lot of destruction of buildings, residences, government buildings, schools. Still a lot of people there in temporary shelter. It's also very clear that now it's been, about 4 months, and things are still quite bad there. But then you also have to look at other places around the world where we've had major quakes, and it seems that it's in those places the rebuilding effort has gone on for years, so it's taken some time. So I guess you have to, when you're looking at a place like Haiti, you have to ask, well, what should we actually expect to be the facts on the ground now, a relatively short time after this happened?
Reconstruction, long-term reconstruction is, well, it's called that because it takes a very long time. And after really big disasters, kind of the standard, as we say, it takes 5 to 10 years. And that's what people were saying after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and we're about the 5-year mark, and it's still going on. It's going to take a long time in Haiti. Right now, they're still really working primarily on cleanup. They're cleaning debris. They're still trying to find safe and reasonably healthy temporary accommodations for people. They're worried about. They were first worried about finding enough tents for people and tarps to keep the weather off of them. They're now worried about hurricane season is coming on. So there's a lot of these short term things that they're worried about. At the same time, they are starting on planning ahead for the long term reconstruction, which is extraordinarily complicated. You know, it's essentially, well, it's not the whole country, but it's certainly the heart of the country. There's approximately 3 million people in Port-au-Prince, and about half of them are homeless as a result of the earthquake. And, you know, it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of organization. And this stuff happens out of the news. And you know, even now, you know, when we read news reports about Haiti, they're talking about the conditions in the camps, which is certainly a legitimate topic to be concerned with, and talking about coming hurricane season and public health issues in the camps. And these are all really important. But, you know, to me, there's also going on at the same time really significant decisions about the long-term reconstruction, which is not going to be easy. There was a brief spurt of news on March 31st. They had International Donors Conference at the UN in New York, and they had been working frantically to create some sort of initial loss estimates and initial plans for what they would do. And the idea was to go and go begging in front of the international community to try and get money, which actually was spectacularly successful. They got pledges of almost $10 billion from the international community. They agreed to organize a commission that would be jointly between the government of Haiti and the UN, co-chaired by the Prime Minister of Haiti and by Bill Clinton, who's the UN Special Envoy to Haiti. And they set this organization up. And again, all this sounds great. You know, it looks like they're well on their way. They've got the right kind of organization. They got the money. And this stuff has fallen out of the news. And I'm just still fascinated by how does they're going to this commission, you know, chaired by these two people, and you know, presumably they're going to have to organize a staff. And this is going to be the funnel through which $10 billion is going to come to rebuild the entire country, which they claim is going to be there's going to be transparent. They're going to encourage sustainability. They're going to decentralize services. There's a whole long list of really attractive things that they claim they're going to do. But how you go about doing that is an entirely different matter, mm-hmm. and this to me is what I'm interested in watching, and I, you know, it's a big challenging question, and these things it's not considered to be newsworthy. You know, we don't really hear much about it, but these are really vital questions that are at least as important as the continuing short-term concerns they have there.
Well, it seemed that there should be no shortage of technical expertise. It should not be the case that we don't know how to do this. But it seems that there's a big difference between how you would sit down on paper and say, "Okay, here's how we do this," and then actually making it happen. And I find myself going back to I stole from something you had written these lines about this tension between wanting to get things done quickly and also wanting to make sure that you make good decisions and that as many people are involved as possible.
Right. And there's some analogies we can use. On sort of one extreme, we can think about what would happen if your house burned down. You know, you would there's several things that you do. The first thing is you hope that you have insurance. If you didn't have insurance or you didn't have enough insurance, you would then be looking for other sources of money. You would have to convince those other sources of money that you had a good plan for what you were going to do. And you would be wanting to rebuild as quickly as you possibly could. But you would also be seeing the opportunity to do some of those things that had been in your mind all along for many years, all the improvements that you wanted to make in your house. And doing some of those might be a little more complicated than rebuilding everything exactly the way it was before. And so you would have that inherent tension, and that would be difficult. And so let's expand that over an entire city where we don't just have one. We do have individuals who own homes are, in fact, struggling with exactly that dilemma. And at the same time, we have the city as a whole with all of its systems and all of the different actors having the same concerns. So it is inherently a complicated problem.
Yeah. We have as our guest in this hour of Focus, Robert Olshansky. He is a professor and also associate head of urban and regional planning at the University of Illinois and is particularly interested in his work in planning for natural hazards. He's done a lot of writing on post-disaster recovery planning, particularly as it applies to earthquake risks. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he's done work in Kobe, Japan, looking at the recovery from the big earthquake they had there in 95. Also, he's looked at Los Angeles, at New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. And so questions are welcome. We have a couple people here ready to go, and so we'll get to the phones and start with a caller in Piatone on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Glad to have this on the show. I come originally from California, so I know what kind of measures or you know, whatnot they have there. I'm a contractor by trade, and I used to build homes and commercial and residential stuff out there. And yeah, there's a lot more different things they have to do there by code because of earthquake, hazards. Out here, which surprises me, since we have tornadoes, I'm surprised that the builders don't build in some kind of a tornado room down in the basement. It's been proven that it does save lives. And I think that would be the smart idea. It shouldn't be an option. It should be added to the house like a light switch or something would be. The other thing is, too, I've been to Holland and Europe and studied on my own a lot of the way they build things, and I was really impressed with the way that the Dutch have built their dikes. A lot of people don't know that Holland's basically an island, floating. And I'm surprised that New Orleans and, places around in the Gulf Coast down there don't adapt some of the ideas that the Dutch have adopted. Some of their dike system seems to be in the world, and yet we kind of flounder around, and we're still rebuilding stuff down there with these antiquated systems. I was wondering what your take is, and would it be worth that? And the same thing would go with lakes and some of the areas that flood down in the swampiness areas down in the any oceanfront property. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, thanks. Well, first, so you're talking about what we call long-term mitigation, trying to reduce the effects of future natural disasters, which is really important. And sometimes these actions come into play. It's sort of an opportune moment after a disaster to get ready for the next one. As far as your first comment on the tornado safe room, the short answer is I agree with you. As far as the Dutch system for their dikes, there have been a lot of discussions between the Dutch and the state of Louisiana and the city of New Orleans. It's sort of ironic, but one of the most opportune times for mitigating the next disaster is after the last one, after the cows are out of the barn, so to speak. But you know there's always going to be another one next time. And, it's not that the Dutch were so smart and they knew that they had a problem they needed to worry about ahead of time. I mean, they've had this problem for many years. But I don't remember the exact date, but it was in the early 1950s. They had a disastrous storm that overwhelmed all the systems that they had. And as a result of that, they've strengthened their systems. They've added this sort of multiple lines of defense kind of strategy. And this is what we're starting to talk about on the Louisiana coast, is both having not only levees but also rehabilitating the wetlands. And having that as an additional line of defense. And on top of that, having homes and structures within the city of New Orleans being made to be more floodproof and more elevated so that even if those other two lines of defense fail, they can rely on those. But this takes a lot of strategies. It takes a lot of time, and nothing is really foolproof. But I certainly appreciate your comment. But we have to appreciate that the reason why the Dutch do it that way is because they also found that the systems that they had previously were inadequate.
Well, I'm sure that you could look at any place, any particular geographic place, and do a risk assessment and talk about, well, what's the most likely disaster that could strike here? Could be flood, could be tornado, could be wildfire, could be earthquake. And then you could say, all right, given that, then let's look at our building codes and our structures and say, here are the things that we can do to make them more robust so that if such a thing should happen, we increase the survivability of people and structures. But then people actually have to be willing to do that, either to make it a requirement, or if you don't make it a requirement, you know, we have to persuade people that it's important, which may indeed end up one way or another spending money. How willing are people actually to do that in advance of the disaster?
This is a continuing battle. Some people are willing to do these things in advance. You know, most people are not. It depends on how much it costs. And, you know, and always mitigating in advance of a disaster, it's always money being spent now to save money at some point at some uncertain point in the future, which individuals are usually reluctant to do if it's a lot of money. Local governments, you know, we know that, you know, every budget is tight. And, you know, usually, you know, if you're going to spend money out of this year's budget or out of your current four-year term of office, chances are the disaster isn't going to happen during that time. And some future politician is going to be the one who's going to get the credit for having done this. So there are lots of disincentives against mitigation. Conversely, there's a lot of places that really do, a lot of communities, a lot of individuals do hazard mitigation for varieties of reasons. And, you know, we try to promote that sort of thing. But, you know, I spent, a couple of decades really working on this idea of hazard mitigation ahead of time, which still is fundamentally is the way to go. But just because of because human nature, it's so difficult to do it. It turns out that we've discovered that the best time, one of the best times to promote hazard mitigation is, again, after disasters. Mm-hmm. The Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000, which is really is what's created the demand for local hazard mitigation plans now throughout the U.S., where the way it really works is you do these plans, which, as you described, you know, you assess all the risks in your community and you list all the actions you should do, and you do those things as money becomes available. But where these plans really become valuable is when the next disaster hits, that FEMA is required to set aside a certain percentage of the money that they provide for rebuilding public facilities. I think it's maybe like 15%. It's not actually said. It's sort of on top of the amount of money that they pay for rebuilding public facilities. And that money is designed to go for hazard mitigation to mitigate against that happening the next time. So, you know, ironically, after the disaster, two things happen. One is people are aware. In Port-au-Prince now, they're aware that they have earthquakes. They should have known. They certainly in New Orleans, they should have known they could have hurricanes. But anyway, people are much more aware of it after the event, and money is flowing then. And so you can take a certain percentage of that money, and again, sort of this idea of building back better. And that's a really a key moment to be able to build in mitigation. And again, New Orleans right now is going to by 5 years from now, is going to be a much safer and more hurricane-resistant place than it was before Hurricane Katrina hit.
We have another caller in Belgium. Line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. In Mr. Inge's introduction to this program, he seemed to be talking about a slightly different topic, and I'd like to ask you about that. And that is, in China, there have been some horrendous earthquakes that have killed hundreds of thousands of people. In Kobe, Japan, there was that large one killed lots of people, too. And many people died in Haiti also. But it's strange, in different cultures, we hear different things about it after the fact. In Iran and Turkey, they have horrible earthquakes there that kill lots of people. In Bangladesh, there's terrible floods. And it just goes on all around the world. But the problem doesn't seem to come to the forefront of the discussions unless it's very close to the United States. And it, that seems to have a strange effect on people. You know what I'm, do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Not exactly.
Well, it, we seem to really worry a whole lot more about the ones that affect people closest to us. But the people in China that, that died, 200,000 of them died, did they get very much aid? Did people hear much happened after that, after the fact? I don't remember hearing too much about it. But now we've heard a lot about New Orleans for several years now. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yes, well, a lot of this has to do with, this is really a question of the media and the news interest. And certainly we're much more interested in things that are closer to home. And, you know, the news will focus on, you know, individual problems in our community, maybe to a greater extent than the earthquake in China. And, you know, then there's the issue of, you know, they would be maybe more interested in Michael Jackson's death than in a large disaster somewhere around the world. So it's really, you know, part of this an issue of media. It's an issue of, you know, of people's interests. I can say that, that from my point of view, you know, I'm always extremely interested in any disaster that happens any place in the world. And also, you know, another point you made, though, is, and this is different than the media, this might have to do with sort of concern of our government or concern of our charitable organizations. And certainly we know that people gave large amounts of money and people gave a lot of service to go to the Gulf Coast to help to clean up after Hurricane Katrina. But, you know, after the 2004 tsunami, you know, there's enormous amounts of donations worldwide, including from the U.S. Billions of dollars were sent for, you know, to help both in the immediate aftermath of that and to help people rebuild. Huge amounts of money have been sent by individuals to Haiti over the last few months. And you know, the international community has stepped up. The United States is offering to I think $1.15 billion, and I read the Senate is actually is hoping to up the ante and even give more money for rebuilding of Haiti. So there really is a lot of international interest. And actually mentioning China, we didn't give a lot of money to China because China actually did a fine job of taking care of themselves in terms of rebuilding after that event. So you know, I think there's two things here. One is sort of media interest, and, you know, that's a whole other topic in terms of the things that, that catch people's interest. But in terms of when there's actually a genuine need for funds for serious disasters in different parts of the world, I think we found that the world in general and our country in particular, and I know individuals in our community, they always step up and do the right thing. We've had – there were several organizations here providing assistance for Haiti. There was the Chinese student organization a couple of years ago was having benefits and collecting money for the earthquake in China. And so I find that we actually – when it comes down to really, really helping when it's needed, we do that.
Well, one of the things you said in your discussion there, sir, really hit exactly on the point that I was trying to get at. And that was the thing you said, the Chinese seem to have taken care of their earthquake problem themselves. Now, is that different in different cultures? And that's really what the point I was trying to get at is in China, they take care of themselves. Turkey, they seem to take care of it themselves. After the initial fact, we hear nothing more about it. Maybe there might be something in Central Africa that happens, and it happens for a while, and then it disappears because they take care of it themselves.
Well,
are cultures that way?
Cultural, but, you know, it has to do with economies. So, you know, developed nations don't really have other developed nations to turn to give them money for their disaster, whereas developing nations that really seriously need external aid will turn to other countries for that. In the case of China, this was really – it was unique the way that they funded the reconstruction after the earthquake, which was 2 years ago. And what they did is, you know, it's just one part of the country, but they, you know, because it's so centralized, the government could basically require the entire country to, you know, all basically pitch in and help. And I don't remember the percentage, but they set up, they paired, you know, municipalities, you know, say Shanghai or Beijing or whatever, the major municipalities in the developed part of the country, they basically had them adopt damaged counties in the earthquake zone, so that they would be individually responsible for rebuilding that particular county, and they required them to set aside a certain percentage of their budget for that year, and I don't remember what it was. So the idea was that they would sort of spread the hit, you know, all over the country, and it also was a way of channeling this expertise. But you could do it because they have the resources, and because it's such a large country, you could organize, you know, 90% of the country to help the 10% of the country. So I think that was a unique circumstance there. Plus, of course, on top of that, they have a governmental system so that the central government could, in fact, just simply require everybody to do that. But so that was something that worked. But that's not going to be the solution in most other places.
Thank you.
Right. That is something I think is worth underscoring. It almost goes without saying is that the ability of a country to rebuild after natural disaster is directly tied to how well they're doing economically. And if you have a place like Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, they're clearly going to need a lot more help in rebuilding than perhaps China or Japan or Turkey, where their economies are in better shape and they're going to have some of their own resources to draw on. In fact, maybe they're not going to need any outside help.
Yeah, that's correct. The thing to remember is after a really large disaster, just thinking about the place that's been affected by that disaster, the first and most important thing that they need is, in fact, outside resources. You know, they need financial resources and even technical assistance from outside that immediate area. So, and this is true everywhere. And so after Hurricane Katrina, the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, the state of Mississippi, they needed outside help. And they got that outside help in part from private insurers, in part from the National Flood Insurance Program, in part from additional funds that Congress had to provide. And this happens everywhere. And so in China, you know, I just described the way that they brought the outside resources into the area. And you have a place like Haiti, which really has no there's nothing else that they have in the country. They have to get it from outside of the country. And maybe, you know, the one we haven't talked about is I mentioned the 2004 tsunami, but it, you know, particularly struck the city of Banda Aceh and the province of Aceh in Indonesia. And, you know, this was, in terms of the level of impact, there was really very similar in a lot of ways to the earthquake in Haiti. Only the difference there is it was a small part of a large country. So Jakarta was able to provide a lot of technical assistance to them. But in addition, Indonesia is a developing nation. So on the one hand, they got the outside resources outside of Aceh from Jakarta. But in part, the country of Indonesia itself also needed to seek outside resources from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And they got donations from other countries. And similarly to the way it's happening with Haiti right now, not quite as much. And so there they used a combination of those things. But so you always need to go starting outside of the area that's immediately struck to get to get financial resources from other places. And then you just keep going as high up as you need to, which is one of the reasons why I've always been, and even before Hurricane Katrina, have always been concerned with what would happen in the event of a really large urban disaster in the U.S., and I still am. You know, there's a lot of large earthquakes in our future, and we don't have nearly as much private earthquake insurance as they did flood insurance after Katrina. And so so there'll be fewer insurance resources, and we don't have any other countries that we can turn to. And so if we have a big disaster, again, an example would be the Kobe earthquake in Japan. They didn't have really other countries they could turn to, and they had to find a way to have their own country use its own resources to be able to pay for it, which had, you know, had effects on the economy. And if we had a really significant earthquake in Seattle or San Francisco or Los Angeles, it would be a significant financial impact on our economy.
We're a little past our midpoint here. I have another call we'll get right to, but for the benefit of anyone who's just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest, Rob Olshansky. He's a professor and associate head of urban and regional planning. He's done a lot of research on planning for natural hazards. He's published a number of things on post-disaster recovery planning and also planning and policy for earthquake risk. He's studied this in a number of places where there have been major earthquakes, most notably Kobe, Bay, Japan, where they had a big earthquake in 1995. He's also been involved in planning and reconstruction in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, and is the co-author of a book that will be coming out later this summer. The title of the book, Clear as Mud, Planning for the Rebuilding of New Orleans. And we're planning on asking him to come back in a couple of months in August when the book comes out. And then we can really talk specifically about New Orleans, although, of course, if people have questions about that, they can certainly call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And, of course, you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's take another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to bring up a couple points and hear your comments on them. First is regarding Haiti, is the governmental corruption and inefficiency, the fact that Haiti doesn't really have a functioning government that was capable of doing public works, that it has a government that's full of economic and other forms of corruption, that there are large-scale differences between the poor and the very rich, and the very rich essentially in Haiti, I'm talking about, the political and economic elites essentially look outside the country for where they can put their energies and their monies. So, connecting this with what you said about China, I mean, one of the reasons that China was able to handle its problems, in addition to what you said about pairing different areas, is the fact that it can organize large groups of people to do public works, whether voluntary or so-called voluntary, and it has large ways of organizing its population so it could use human power accomplish things that in other areas money and higher technology are required. So that, for instance, in Haiti, there doesn't seem an ability to organize the population to do major public works. That's an area that we can maybe look to, but it requires an efficient government, which Haiti doesn't have. And the other part has to do with what you brought up originally with Bill Clinton, et cetera, because of the issue of the corruption and the fear that any money that goes to Haiti that isn't tightly controlled will disappear. So I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay. Well, obviously part of the challenge in Haiti is that there's a lot of different kinds of rebuilding that are going on. We have to physically rebuild the city of Port-au-Prince. We have to rebuild the economy. But in the case of Haiti, we're also looking at rebuilding governance. And that's a major challenge. There is a precedent for that. I mentioned Banda Aceh. The province of Aceh at the time of the tsunami had civil war for 30 years. There was no local government capacity of any sort. And so one of the things that the central government in Jakarta set up was they brought in a commission whose job was to, you know, basically be like the training wheels to get things operating again, to build local government capacity, and after, I think it was 3 years or 4 years, to hand off some of those things to the local government. So part of what they were doing was building capacity and building local governance and local government, creating contracting procedures and so on. And as far as I know, that's been at least reasonably successful. And that's the challenge in Haiti. It's a lot more difficult because in the case of Indonesia, it was sort of one part of the country helping another part of the country. And that's why in Haiti they've set up this joint commission jointly with the government of Haiti and the prime minister and with the UN. And the idea is that they'll working together, that the UN and the World Bank is going to be involved and other international agencies will be also helping to train the Haitians and trying to change the culture in Haiti, which is certainly a tall order. And to me, I think is probably the most daunting of all the tasks that they're trying to do. But I think it has some real possibilities for success. My experience, admittedly, was just 1 week in Haiti, but I found the people to be very hardworking. We saw, you know, in terms of you talking about organizing people to do public works, we actually saw some of that. They have these cash for work programs that are supported by international agencies, including USAID and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, where this is how they're doing the debris removal and how they're doing some of the initial drainage improvements that they need to do in order to get ready for the hurricane season. And there were just dozens of people out there wearing, you know, color-coded T-shirts, depending on what agency they were working for, who were working to clear the streets and clear the drainage ways. And I think it would be very easy to then, you know, extend that thinking to be able to mobilize that population to be able to do some of the longer-term public works that you're talking about. So I think there's, I mean, I think you have the right idea, and I think that's certainly one of the things that they're hoping to do. But, you know, again, it's going to be a big challenge how to organize this. But everybody who I've talked to, including some extremely high government officials, their hope is that this is the opportunity that they're going to be able to take advantage of this and improve their system of governance. From the things that I've read, there had been actually some significant improvements over the last year or two leading into this as well. And in fact, Bill Clinton gave a recognized speech in, I think it was in October, where he was speaking very optimistically about a lot of the progress they made and talking about some of the things that they had planned in the coming years. So I think things were in the process of moving in the right direction. And from what I could tell talking to people now, they're very hopeful that they're going to be able to make it work. But that still doesn't mean that it's not going to be an extremely difficult challenge. And again, you know, bringing in, you know, New Orleans, which is a very different kind of situation, but there were serious governance problems in New Orleans and Louisiana as well. And we certainly haven't solved all of them. But there's a long list of you know, I could list you many different improvements that have been made as a result of Hurricane Katrina in terms of a lot of the new laws, government procedures. The new mayor taking over New Orleans, I think, is going to continue a lot of that. And so it is possible to make significant improvements in governance after disasters like this if there's the will to do so. And that's the intent both of the government of Haiti and of the UN and the international agencies right now is to try to do that in Haiti.
Hope you're right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things that I know you've looked at in your work is that the difficulty of governments in responding to these crises. And I'm sure that that is the case even where governments function well, because by their nature, you know, government bureaucracies, they don't move that fast. And here is a case where you want to move with some dispatch, particularly to take care of people's immediate needs for things like shelter and food and sanitation and water and so forth. And that it sounds as if that's always a problem.
Yes, indeed. That's really one of the great challenges of post-disaster recovery and one of the things that I've been interested in continuing to look at, which is that government bureaucracies are not well-suited to this situation. You need flexibility. You need agencies that are nimble. You need to be able to make quick decisions. You need a lot of creativity. And government agencies aren't good at any of those kinds of things. And you read over and over again after these events where they talk about how, you know, citizen organizations pop up and how citizens complain that government wasn't fast enough, government didn't do the job, government is useless, so they've started their own organizations. And it turns out that that's exactly the right thing to do. That you actually need these kinds of emergent organizations after disasters to do a lot of the organizing, a lot of the creativity, a lot of the action really happens through these organizations. And so realizing that, I still focus on the role of government. And to me, because it's not like government is irrelevant. Government has an important role to play. But the question is, what is that role? And I've always seen it as primarily a means of coordination, and coordination not meaning sort of ordering around all of the, telling all those independent new organizations what to do, but trying to facilitate, trying to help them, trying to set up means of communication between them, providing technical assistance to them, providing funding support to them, not getting in their way and slowing them down. And I think another really important role of government is in general to be sort of a central point of information To be sort of the go-to place, the clearinghouse, if you will, where people can bring information, where if you want to know what's going on, you'll go to the government agency, but you know they won't necessarily tell you what they're doing, but they'll have a means of telling you what others are doing and helping you to get organized with each other. And then finally, government has a really important role, and there are certain public investments that we make in terms of you know basic infrastructure and public facilities, and those investments can in turn catalyze a lot of private decision making. So that you know that's the way we view it in the U.S. And again, so in a place like Haiti, we have sort of a double problem that we have this need for a limited role of government, and even they're even challenged to do that. Now, one of the other things in Haiti, in particular, is this has long been the case that government has not been up to the task of what needs to be done, and so the country is overrun with non-governmental organizations, particularly international ones. And a lot of people have actually recognized this as a problem, that even though in a lot of places it's good to have that sort of energy of all those organizations, that in fact they've gone too far, that they really need to have a stronger government to help to at least coordinate or you know, at least you know have a directory of who all those international NGOs are. So again, one of the goals in Haiti in particular is to strengthen the government. Whereas I would say that after a really big disaster in the U.S., and again, this was certainly the case in New Orleans, that we would be thinking about the other way. We would be thinking about how we could help all of those emergent organizations to do their job better. Hmm. But in Haiti, I think we're thinking in the other direction.
We have just about 10 minutes left. Let me introduce again our guest, Rob Olshansky. He is a professor and associate head of urban and regional planning at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about post-disaster recovery both in the U.S. and abroad. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, something else, I think that it's when you think of what it is that people need after a disaster like this, there are some things that seem to be pretty obvious. They're going to need shelter. They're going to need food. They're going to need clean water. There have to be provisions for sanitation. But people also need work. The dislocation to the economy no doubt means that a lot of people have lost whatever it was they were doing to make their living before is gone, at least temporarily, and maybe even you know over a longer term. So you'd say, well, here's the great possibility, potential here. We have people who need work, who want to work, who could be employed in rebuilding. But then also you have to ask, well, what kind of specialized skills do you need and do people have them and what exactly is involved? How do you really integrate into the recovery effort and the rebuilding effort the people who live in this place?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, there's a whole lot of good questions embedded in that good question. So, you know, what do you do first after a really big disaster? And what are the list of things that you need? Homes and livelihoods would be the things that we would have at the top of the list. But there's a whole lot of things that you need to support livelihoods, to have a strong economy. You need a strong infrastructure. You need to rebuild your schools. You need medical services. You need all of those kinds of things. You need them all at the same time. You need all of them before all of the other things, which is impossible to do. And this is why it's such a difficult, unpleasant, and contentious process, because you never have all the things in place that you need to have in place at the time. The way I view it is really, you know, it's not, you know, some people ask me, you know, what's the first thing you need to do? And it's not, there's nobody who decides the first thing that you need to do. There are many different actors involved. And if you think about this, you know, we're taking city building and we're compressing it into a short time period. So if you think about all the things that are involved in building a city over, you know, decades or centuries, you know, there are many different people involved. There's individual families involved. There's businesses involved. you know, of all different sizes, public agencies involved, and they're all making different decisions. They're organizing their social networks and economic networks among themselves that grow and evolve over time. And, you know, the role of public agencies, the roles of planners in all this over time is to help to, you know, make the system as intelligent as possible, to help to inform it, to provide assistance, to help to prod it in the right direction. And that's how we do things. And so thinking about doing this all in a really short amount of time, it's all the same problem. This is why I'm interested in this as a planner. It's all the same complexities of city building and city planning as we have in normal times, but everything is much more exaggerated. I would say, given all of this, given all these different actors and all these different things, you know, I mentioned the role of money is really important, and I've talked about the role of information. And I think those are really the two most significant roles of government to help to feed the system. You know, think about it as, you know, again, whatever analogy you want to think of as a garden or whatever, and you know, everything is growing on its own, or an ecological system. And what you need to do is you need to feed the system by providing resources to it. And the primary resources, I think, are money and information. And then understanding that, in fact, the goal, one of the ways that I've learned from one of my Japanese colleagues is in the end, viewing recoveries, in the end, it's all about household recovery. It's all about families or households having a home to live in and having livelihoods to support themselves, having something to do. And there's a lot of other things that are implied by that, is you need systems to be able to support all those things. But in the end, that's the measure of whether you've succeeded or not. So I would say another important role is to build into that monitoring systems to understand to what degree households are, in fact, recovering based on those criteria. And if we see problems, then we try to push the system a little bit better in some of those directions to help those things happen.
Yeah. I'm sure that if you were a city planner and your city was devastated by a natural disaster, and you'd be standing there and amidst the rubble, and you'd be thinking about, okay, where do we start and what do we do and how do we rebuild? You'd have to say to yourself, well, I know there's no way that we're going to rebuild what was. And in fact, there are probably some things about what was we wouldn't want to rebuild. So what I'm wondering is that is there a way to encourage city planners to think like this? Okay, supposing that a giant hand came along and swept the city away and you had to start again. How would you do it? What would you keep? What would you not rebuild? What would you do differently? Can you encourage people to actually have that kind of a plan with the idea that, you know, you wouldn't want that to happen, but if it did, you would actually have a plan?
Well, yes, we have been trying to encourage communities to think about having sort of pre-disaster recovery plans. There's very few places that have them. The city of Los Angeles actually had one that was almost done at the time of its 1994 earthquake and really helped them considerably. Mm-hmm. The state of Florida they're working on requiring it of all their coastal communities. This is a process that's going on right now, which I think is really very promising. But I would argue that even if you're just doing planning, normal city planning, you know, we go through a process in our community where we're trying to think of, you know, what are the strengths and weaknesses of our community and what are the things that we would like to be able to do to improve it should resources become available. And if you've had that kind of process and you have planning institutions and you have neighborhood planning organizations, you have a structure in your community where you're having planning discussions, and then a big disaster comes, you just continue with what you're doing. It provides you the opportunity to do the things that you knew you wanted. Whereas conversely, if you don't have normal planning processes and normal planning institutions going on and you get hit by a disaster, then you have to do this all. You have to invent it all after the disaster to think about what you liked about the community, what you didn't like, where the room for improvement is, you know, what are the kinds of things that you might be able to do, where do you have consensus. So I would argue, at the very least, I think this is one of the best arguments for my field of city planning of anything, is it makes you better able to deal with crises. And that's not just, you know, a natural disaster, but it could be, you know, home foreclosure crises or other types of crises that might strike your city. To the degree to which you're having these planning conversations makes you better equipped to know what you want and how to deal with unexpected events.
Yeah, and just very quickly, though, I'm sure that in this, the thing that you have to allow for is people's wanting to return to some kind of a stability that they knew before, so that you, as much as you might like to do something radical and move things around, that one of the things that we know is after a disaster, people want to go back to the place where they were. They don't want to be moved to the other side of town. They no matter what, they have ties to their neighborhood, to their social network, and there are strong things that drive people to want to go right back to that same place. And I'm sure that as planners, that's something that you have to deal with.
That's true. And this is the essential tension at the middle of this. And I thank you for bringing this up at the end. We can talk about this for another hour. But this is the essential dilemma at the middle of it. And to me, the challenge is to try to maximize the opportunities for improvement. And, you know, in the end, most cities rebuild the way they were before the disaster. And so to me, my challenge is to try and see, can I make it 20% better, 23% better? You know, how much can we enhance that possibility of making it better than it was before? And after every disaster, again, cities usually rebuild the way they were before, but there is always some amount of improvement. And so my goal is to try and find out how we can increase the amount of improvement that will take place.
Well, I'm sure that we will have the opportunity to talk some more about this. I mentioned that there is a book which you have co-authored that's titled Clear as Mud, Planning for the Rebuilding of New Orleans. And I guess I thought that it was yet to come out, but in fact, it's out now, right?
Yes, it's available. You can get it online from the American Planning Association. But if you want to wait until August, it'll be widely available on Amazon at a different pricing in August. But we encourage people to buy copies of it now.
All right. And a little bit later in the summer, then you'll come back and we can talk about that and talk a little bit more specifically about New Orleans and maybe get into this very issue that I have raised here right at the end.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Good, thank you.
Our guest for this hour of Focus, Rob Olshansky. He's professor and associate head of urban and regional planning here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.